ringing the changes. 1. August 1959. When the intern came outside, half an hour later, he found Julio leaning against the ambulance, which was still parked in the emergency bay of Sisters of Mercy Hospital on 23rd Street. The heel of one of Julio's pointy-toed boots was hooked over the front fender. He had changed to a pair of glaring pink pants and a blue shirt with his name written in gold stitches over the left pocket. His bowling league outfit. George checked his watch and saw that Julio's team, the Spix of Supremacy, would already be rolling. "Thought you'd be gone," George Shavers said. He was an intern at Sisters of Mercy. "How are you guys going to win without the Wonder Hook?"
"They got Miguel Basal to take my place. He ain't steady, but he gets hot sometimes. They'll be okay."
Julio paused.
"I was curious about how it came out."
He was the driver, a Cubano with a sense of humor George wasn't even sure Julio knew he had. He looked around. Neither of the paramedics who rode with them were in sight.
"Where are they?"
George asked.
"Who, the fucking Bubsy twins? Where do you think they are, chasing Minnesota Poontang down in the village? Any idea if she'll pull through?"
"Don't know." He tried to sound sage and knowing about the unknown, but the fact was that first the resident on duty and then a pair of surgeons had taken the black woman away from him almost faster than you could say Hail Mary full of grace, which had actually been on his lips to say. The black lady really hadn't looked as if she was going to last very long.
"She lost a hell of a lot of blood."
"No shit." George was one of 16 interns at Sisters of Mercy, and one of 8 assigned to a new program called Emergency Ride. The theory was that an intern riding with a couple of paramedics could sometimes make the difference between life and death in an emergency situation. George knew that most drivers and paras thought that wet-behind-the-ears interns were as likely to kill red blankets as save them, but George thought maybe it worked. Sometimes. Either way, it made great PR for the hospital, and although the interns in the program liked to bitch about the extra 8 hours without pay it entailed each week, George Shavers sort of thought that most of them felt the way he did himself. Proud, tough, able to take whatever they threw his way. Then had come the night the TWA TriStar crashed at Idlewild. 65 people on board, 60 of them what Julio Estevez referred to as DRT, dead right there, and 3 of the remaining 5 looking like the sort of thing you might scrape out of the bottom of a coal furnace. Except what you scraped out of the bottom of a coal furnace didn't moan and shriek and beg for someone to give them morphine or kill them, did they? "If you can take this," he thought afterward, remembering the severed limbs lying amid the remains of aluminum flaps and seat cushions and a ragged chunk of tail with a number 17 and a big red-letter T and part of a W on it, remembering the eyeball he had seen resting on top of a charred Samsonite suitcase, remembering a child's teddy bear with staring shoe-button eyes lying beside a small red sneaker with a child's foot still in it. "If you can take this, baby, you can take anything." And he had been taking it just fine. He went right on taking it just fine all the way home. He went on taking it just fine through a late supper that consisted of a Swanson's turkey TV dinner. He went to sleep with no problem at all, which proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was taking it just fine. Then, in some dead, dark hour of the morning, he had awakened from a hellish nightmare, in which the thing resting on top of the charred Samsonite suitcase had not been a teddy bear, but his mother's head, and her eyes had opened, and they had been charred. They were the staring, expressionless shoe-button eyes of the teddy bear, and her mouth had opened, revealing the broken fangs which had been her dentures up until the TWA TriStar was struck by lightning on its final approach, and she had whispered, "You couldn't save me, George. We scrimped for you, we saved for you, we went without for you. Your dad fixed up the scrape you got into with that girl, and you still couldn't save me, goddamn you!" And he had awakened, screaming, and he was vaguely aware of someone pounding on the wall, but by then he was already pelting into the bathroom, and he barely made it to the kneeling penitential position before the porcelain altar, before dinner came up the express elevator. It came special delivery, hot and steaming and still smelling like processed turkey. He knelt there and looked into the bowl at the chunks of half-digested turkey and the carrots which had lost none of their original fluorescent brightness, and this word flashed across his mind in large red letters. Enough. Correct. It was enough. He was going to get out of the sawbones business. He was going to get out because enough was enough. He was going to get out because Popeye's motto was, "That's all I can stand, and I can't stand no more," and Popeye was as right as rain. He had flushed the toilet and gone back to bed and fell asleep almost instantly and awoke to discover he still wanted to be a doctor, and that was a goddamn good thing to know for sure. Maybe worth the whole program, whether you called it Emergency Ride or Bucket of Blood or name that tune. He still wanted to be a doctor. He knew a lady who did needlework. He paid her $10 he couldn't afford to make him a small, old-fashioned-looking sampler. It said, "If you can take this, you can take anything." Yes, correct. The messy business in the subway happened 4 weeks later. 2.
"That lady was some fucking weird, you know it?" Julio said.
George breathed an interior sigh of relief. If Julio hadn't opened the subject, George supposed he wouldn't have had the sack. He was an intern, and someday he was going to be a full-fledged doc. He really believed that now. But Julio was a vet, and you didn't want to say something stupid in front of a vet. He would only laugh and say, "Hell, I seen that shit 1,000 times, kid. Get yourself a towel and wipe off whatever it is behind your ears, because it's wet and dripping down the sides of your face." But apparently Julio hadn't seen it 1,000 times, and that was good, because George wanted to talk about it. She was weird, all right. It was like she was two people. He was amazed to see that now Julio was the one who looked relieved, and he was struck with sudden shame. Julio Estevez, who was going to do no more than pilot a limo with a couple of pulsing red lights on top for the rest of his life, had just shown more courage than he had been able to show.
"You got it, Doc. 100%.
He pulled out a pack of Chesterfields and stuck one in the corner of his mouth. "Those things are going to kill you, my man," George said. Julio nodded and offered the pack. They smoked in silence for a while. The paras were maybe chasing tail, like Julio had said, or maybe they'd just had enough. George had been scared, all right, no joke about that. But he also knew he had been the one who saved the woman, not the paras, and he knew Julio knew it too. Maybe that was really why Julio had waited. The old black woman had helped, and the white kid who had dialed the cops while everyone else except the old black woman had just stood around watching, like it was some goddamn movie or TV show or something, part of a Peter Gunn episode, maybe. But in the end, it had all come down to George Shavers, one scared cat doing his duty the best way he could. The woman had been waiting for the train Duke Ellington held in such high regard, that fabled A-train. Just been a pretty young black woman in jeans and a khaki shirt waiting for the fabled A-train so she could go uptown someplace. Someone had pushed her. George Shavers didn't have the slightest idea if the police had caught the slug who had done it. That wasn't his business. His business was the woman who had tumbled screaming into the tube of the tunnel in front of that fabled A-train. It had been a miracle that she had missed the third rail, the fabled third rail that would have done to her what the state of New York did to the bad guys up at Sing Sing who got a free ride on that fabled A-train the cons called Old Sparky. Oh boy, the miracles of electricity. She tried to crawl out of the way, but there hadn't been quite enough time, and that fabled A-train had come into the station screeching and squalling and puking up sparks because the motorman had seen her, but it was too late for him and too late for her. The steel wheels of that fabled A-train had cut the living legs off her from just above the knees down. And while everyone else, except for the white kid who had dialed the cops, had only stood there pulling their puds, or pushing their pudenda, George supposed, the elderly black woman had jumped down, dislocating one hip in the process. She would later be given a Medal of Bravery by the mayor, and had used the do-rag on her head to cinch a tourniquet around one of the young woman's squirting thighs. The young white guy was screaming for an ambulance on one side of the station, and the old black chick was screaming for someone to give her a help, to give her a tie-off, for God's sake, anything, anything at all, and finally some elderly white business type had reluctantly surrendered his belt, and the elderly black chick looked up at him and spoke the words which became the headline of the New York Daily News the next day, the words which made her an authentic American apple pie heroine.
Thank you, bro.
Then she had noosed the belt around the young woman's left leg, halfway between the young woman's crotch and where her left knee had been, until that fabled A-train had come along. George had heard someone say to someone else that the young black woman's last words before passing out had been, "Who was that muffa? I'm gonna hunt him down and kill his ass." There was no way to punch holes far enough up for the elderly black woman to notch the belt, so she simply held on like grim old death until Julio, George, and the Paras arrived. George remembered the yellow line, how his mother had told him he must never, never, never go past the yellow line while he was waiting for a train, fabled or otherwise, the stench of oil and electricity when he hopped down onto the cinders, remembered how hot it had been. The heat seemed to be baking off him, off the elderly black woman, off the young black woman, off the train, the tunnel, the unseen sky above, and hell itself beneath. He remembered thinking incoherently, if they put a blood pressure cuff on me now, I'd go off the dial. And then he went cool and yelled for his bag. And when one of the paras tried to jump down with it, he told the para to fuck off. And the para had looked startled, as if he was really seeing George Shavers for the first time, and he had fucked off. George tied off as many veins and arteries as he could tie off, and when her heart started to bebop, he had shot her full of digitalin. Whole blood arrived. Cops brought it. "Want to bring her up, Doc?" one of them had asked, and George had told him not yet, and he got out the needle and stuck the juice to her like she was a junkie in dire need of a fix. Then he let them take her up. Then they had taken her back. On the way, she had awakened. Then the weirdness started. 3. George gave her a shot of Demerol when the paras loaded her into the ambulance. She had begun to stir and cry out weakly. He gave her a boost hefty enough for him to be confident she would remain quiet until they got to Sisters of Mercy. He was 90% sure she would still be with them when they got there, and that was one for the good guys. Her eyes began to flutter while they were still 6 blocks from the hospital, however. She uttered a thick moan. "We can shoot her up again, Doc," one of the paras said. George was hardly aware this was the first time a paramedic had deigned to call him anything other than George, or worse, Georgie. "Are you nuts? I just as soon not confuse DOA and OD if it's all the same to you." The paramedic drew back. George looked back at the young black woman and saw the eyes returning his gaze were awake and aware.
"What has happened to me?" she asked.
George remembered the man who had told another man about what the woman had supposedly said, how she was going to hunt the motherfucker down and kill his ass, etc., etc. That man had been white. George decided now it had been pure invention, inspired either by that odd human urge to make naturally dramatic situations even more dramatic, or just race prejudice. This was a cultured, intelligent woman. "You've had an accident," he said. "You were..." Her eyes slipped shut, and he thought she was going to sleep again. Good. Let someone else tell her she had lost her legs. Someone who made more than $7,600 a year. He had shifted a little to the left, wanting to check her BP again, when she opened her eyes once more. When she did, George Shavers was looking at a different woman.
"Fucker cut off my legs. I felt him go. This the ambulance?"
Yes. George said. Suddenly he needed something to drink. Not necessarily alcohol, just something wet. His voice was dry. This was like watching Spencer Tracy and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, only for real.
"They get that honky muffa?"
"No," George said, thinking the guy got it right. God damn, the guy did actually get it right. He was vaguely aware that the paramedics, who had been hovering, perhaps hoping he would do something wrong, we're now backing off.
"Good. Honky Fuzz just be letting him off anyway. I'll be getting him. I'll be cutting his cock off. Son of a bitch. I tell you what I'm going to do to that son of a bitch. I'll tell you one thing, you son of a bitch honky. I'm going to tell you to..."
Her eyes fluttered again, and George had thought, yes, go to sleep. Please, go to sleep. I don't get paid for this. I don't understand this. They told us about shock, but nobody mentioned schizophrenia as one of the... The eyes opened. The first woman was there.
"What sort of accident was it?" she asked. "I remember coming out of the eye."
"Eye? he said stupidly. She smiled a little. It was a painful smile.
The Hungry Eye, it's a coffee house.
Oh, yeah, right. The other one, hurt or not, had made him feel dirty and a little ill. This one made him feel like a knight in an Arthurian tale, a knight who has successfully rescued the Lady Fair from the jaws of the dragon.
I remember walking down the stairs to the platform, and after that,
someone pushed you. It sounded stupid, but what was wrong with that? It was stupid.
Pushed me in front of the train?
Yes.
Have I lost my legs?
George tried to swallow and couldn't. There seemed to be nothing in his throat to grease the machinery.
Not all of them, he said inanely, and her eyes closed. Let it be a feint, he thought then. Please let it be a...
They opened, blazing. One hand came up and slashed 5 slits through the air within an inch of his face. Any closer and he would have been in the ER getting his cheek stitched up instead of smoking chesties with Julio Estevez.
You ain't nothing but a bunch of honky sons of bitches,
she screamed. Her face was monstrous, her eyes full of hell's own light. It wasn't even the face of a human being.
Gonna kill every motherfucking honky I see. Gonna geld them first. Gonna cut off their balls and spit them in their faces.
It was crazy. She talked like a cartoon black woman. Butterfly McQueen gone Looney Tunes. She, or it, also seemed superhuman. This screaming, writhing thing could not have just undergone impromptu surgery by subway train 30 minutes ago. She bit, she clawed out at him again and again, snot spat from her nose, spit flew from her lips, filth poured from her mouth.
"Shoot her up, Doc!"
one of the paras yelled. His face was pale.
"For Christ's sake, shoot her up!"
The para reached toward the supply case. George shoved his hand aside. "Fuck off, chicken shit!" George looked back at his patient and saw the calm, cultured eyes of the other one looking at him.
"Will I live?"
she asked in a conversational tea-room voice. He thought she is unaware of her lapses, totally unaware. And after a moment, so is the other one, for that matter. He gulped, rubbed at his galloping heart through his tunic, and then ordered himself to get control of this. He had saved her life. Her mental problems were not his concern.
"Are you all right?"
she asked him, and the genuine concern in her voice made him smile a little, her asking him.
"Yes, ma'am." "To which question are you responding?"
For a moment he didn't understand, then did.
"Both,"
he said, and took her hand. She squeezed it, and he looked into her shining, lucent eyes and thought a man could fall in love. And that was when her hand turned into a claw, and she was telling him he was a honky muffa, and she wasn't just gonna take his balls, she's gonna chew on those muffas. He pulled away, looking to see if his hand was bleeding, thinking incoherently that if it was, he would have to do something about it because she was poison, the woman was poison, and being bitten by her would be about the same as being bitten by a copperhead or rattler. There was no blood. And when he looked again, it was the other woman, the first woman.
"Please," she said, "I don't want to die. Please."
Then she went out for good. And that was good for all of them. 4.
"So what you think?"
Julio asked. "About who's going to be in the series?" George squashed the butt under the heel of his loafer. "White socks. I got him in the pool."
"What you think about that lady?"
"I think she might be schizophrenic," George said slowly.
"Yeah, I know that. I mean, what's going to happen to her?"
"I don't know."
"She needs help, man. Who going to give it?"
"Well, I already gave her one," George said, but his face felt hot, as if he were blushing. Julio looked at him.
"If you already gave her all the help you can give her, you should have let her die, Doc."
George looked at Julio for a moment, but found he couldn't stand what he saw in Julio's eyes. Not accusation, but sadness. So he walked away. He had places to go. 5. The time of the drawing. In the time since the accident, it was, for the most part, still Odetta Holmes who was in control. But Detta Walker had come forward more and more. The thing Detta liked to do best was steal. It didn't matter that her booty was always little more than junk, no more than it mattered that she often threw it away later. The taking was what mattered. When the gunslinger entered her head in Macy's, Detta screamed in a combination of fury and horror and terror, her hands freezing on the junk jewelry she was scooping into her purse. She screamed because when Roland came into her mind, when he came forward, she for a moment sensed the other, as if a door had been swung open inside of her head. And she screamed because the invading, raping presence was a honky. She could not see, but nonetheless sensed his whiteness. People looked around. A floorwalker saw the screaming woman in the wheelchair with her purse open, saw one hand frozen in the act of stuffing costume jewelry into a purse that looked, even from a distance of 30 feet, worth 3 times the stuff she was stealing. The floorwalker yelled, "Hey, Jimmy!" And Jimmy Halverson, one of Macy's house detectives, looked around and saw what was happening. He started toward the black woman in the wheelchair on a dead run. He couldn't help running. He had been a city cop for 18 years, and it was built into his system. But he was already thinking it was going to be a shit bust. Little kids, cripples, nuns, they were always a shit bust. Busting them was like kicking a drunk. They cried a little in front of the judge and then took a walk. It was hard to convince judges that cripples could also be slime. But he ran just the same. 6. Roland was momentarily horrified by the snake pit of hate and revulsion in which he found himself. And then he heard the woman screaming, saw the big man with the potato sack belly running toward her, him, saw people looking, and took control. Suddenly he was the woman with the dusky hands. He sensed some strange duality inside her, but couldn't think about it now. He turned the chair and began to shove it forward. The aisle rolled past him, her. People dived away to either side. The purse was lost, spilling Detta's credentials and stolen treasure in a wide trail along the floor. The man with the heavy gut skidded on bogus gold chains and lipstick tubes and then fell on his ass. 7. Shit! Halverson thought furiously, and for a moment one hand clawed under his sport coat, where there was a .38 in a clamshell holster. Then sanity reasserted itself. This was no drug bust or armed robbery. This was a crippled black lady in a wheelchair. She was rolling it like it was some punk's drag racer, but a crippled black lady was all she was just the same. What was he going to do, shoot her? That would be great, wouldn't it? And where was she going to go? There was nothing at the end of the aisle but 2 dressing rooms. He picked himself up, massaging his aching ass, and began after her again, limping a little now. The wheelchair flashed into one of the dressing rooms. The door slammed, just clearing the push handles on the back. "Gotcha now, bitch," Jimmy thought. "And I'm going to give you one hell of a scare. I don't care if you got 5 orphan children and only a year to live. I'm not going to hurt you, but, oh, babe, I'm going to shake your dice." He beat the floorwalker to the dressing room, slammed the door open with his left shoulder, and it was empty. No black woman, no wheelchair, no nothing. He looked at the floorwalker, starry-eyed. "Other one!" the floorwalker yelled. "Other one!" Before Jimmy could move, the floorwalker had busted open the door of the other dressing room. A woman in a linen skirt and a Playtex living bra screamed piercingly and crossed her arms over her chest. She was very white and very definitely not crippled. "Pardon me," the floorwalker said, feeling hot crimson flood his face. "Get out of here, you pervert!" the woman in the linen skirt and the bra cried. "Yes, ma'am," the floorwalker said, and closed the door. At Macy's, the customer was always right. He looked at Halverson. Halverson looked back. "What is this shit?" Halverson asked. "Did she go in there or not?" "Yeah, she did." "So where is she?" The floorwalker could only shake his head. "Let's go back and pick up the mess." "You pick up the mess," Jimmy Halverson said. "I feel like I just broke my ass in 9 pieces. He paused. "To tell you the truth, me fine bucko, I also feel extremely confused." 8. The moment the gunslinger heard the dressing room door bang shut behind him, he rammed the wheelchair around in a half-turn, looking for the doorway. If Eddie had done what he had promised, it would be gone. But the door was open. Roland wheeled the Lady of Shadows through it. Chapter 3. Odetta on the Other Side. 1. Not long after, Roland would think, any other woman, crippled or otherwise, suddenly shoved all the way down the aisle of the mart in which she was doing business, monkey business, you may call it if you like, by a stranger inside her head, shoved into a little room while some man behind her yelled for her to stop, then suddenly turned, shoved again where there was by rights no room in which to shove, then finding herself suddenly in an entirely different world, I think any other woman, under those circumstances, would most certainly have asked, "Where am I?" before all else. Instead, Odetta Holmes asked almost pleasantly, "What exactly are you planning to do with that knife, young man?" 2. Roland looked up at Eddie, who was crouched with his knife held less than a quarter of an inch over the skin. Even with his uncanny speed, there was no way the gunslinger could move fast enough to evade the blade if Eddie decided to use it. "Yes," Roland said. "What are you planning to do with it?" "I don't know," Eddie said, sounding completely disgusted with himself. "Cut bait, I guess. Sure doesn't look like I came here to fish, does it?" He threw the knife toward the lady's chair, but well to the right. It stuck, quivering, in the sand to its hilt. Then the lady turned her head and began, "I wonder if you could please explain where you've taken—" She stopped. She had said, "I wonder if you," before her head had gotten around far enough to see there was no one behind her. But the gunslinger observed, with some real interest, that she went on speaking for a moment anyway, because the fact of her condition made certain things elementary truths of her life. If she had moved, for instance, someone must have moved her. But there was no one behind her. No one at all. She looked back at Eddie and the gunslinger, her dark eyes troubled, confused, and alarmed. And now she asked, "Where am I? Who pushed me? How can I be here? How can I be dressed, for that matter, when I was home watching the 12 o'clock news in my robe? Who am I? Where is this? Who are you?" "Who am I?" she asked, the gunslinger thought. The dam broke, and there was a flood of questions that was to be expected. But that one question, "Who am I?" Even now, I don't think she knows she asked it. Or when. Because she had asked before. Even before she had asked who they were, she had asked who she was. 3. Eddie looked from the lovely, young, old face of the black woman in the wheelchair to Roland's face. "How come she doesn't know?" "I can't say. Shock, I suppose." "Shock took her all the way back to her living room before she left for Macy's? You telling me the last thing she remembers is sitting in her bathrobe and listening to some blow-dried dude talk about how they found that gonzo down in the Florida Keys with Krista McAuliffe's left hand mounted on his den wall next to his prize marlin?" Roland didn't answer. More dazed than ever, the lady said, "Who is Krista McAuliffe? Is she one of the missing Freedom Riders?" Now it was Eddie's turn not to answer. Freedom Riders? What the hell were they? The gunslinger glanced at him, and Eddie was able to read his eyes easily enough. "Can't you see she's in shock?" "I know what you mean, Roland, old buddy, but it only washes up to a point. I felt a little shock myself when you came busting into my head like Walter Payton on crack, but it didn't wipe out my memory banks." Speaking of shock, he'd gotten another pretty good jolt when she came through. He had been kneeling over Roland's inert body, the knife just above the vulnerable skin of the throat. But the truth was, Eddie couldn't have used the knife anyway. Not then, anyway. He was staring into the doorway, hypnotized, as an aisle of Macy's rushed forward. He was reminded again of The Shining, where you saw what the little boy was seeing as he rode his trike through the hallways of that haunted hotel. He remembered the little boy had seen this creepy pair of dead twins in one of those hallways. The end of this aisle was much more mundane, a white door. The words, "Only two garments at one time, please," were printed on it in discreet lettering. Yeah, it was Macy's, all right. Macy's for sure. One black hand flew out and slammed the door open, while the male voice, a cop voice, if Eddie had ever heard one, and he had heard many in his time, behind, yelled for her to quit it. That was no way out. She was only making things a hell of a lot worse for herself. And Eddie caught a bare glimpse of the black woman in the wheelchair in the mirror to the left, and he remembered thinking, Jesus, he's got her all right, but she sure don't look happy about it. Then the view pivoted, and Eddie was looking at himself. The view rushed toward the viewer, and he wanted to put up the hand holding the knife to shield his eyes, because all at once the sensation of looking through two sets of eyes was too much, too crazy. It was going to drive him crazy if he didn't shut it out. But it all happened too fast for him to have time. The wheelchair came through the door. It was a tight fit, and he heard its hub squeal on the sides. At the same moment he heard another sound, a thick, tearing sound that made him think of some word, placental, that he couldn't quite think of because he didn't know he knew it. Then the woman was rolling toward him on the hard-packed sand, and she no longer looked mad as hell. Hardly looked like the woman Eddie had glimpsed in the mirror at all, for that matter, but he supposed that wasn't surprising. When you all at once went from a changing room at Macy's to the seashore of a godforsaken world where some of the lobsters were the size of small collie dogs, it left you feeling a little winded. That was a subject on which Eddie Dean felt he could personally give testimony. She rolled about 4 feet before stopping, and only went that far because of the slope and the gritty pack of the sand. Her hands were no longer pumping the wheels, as they must have been doing. When you wake up with sore shoulders tomorrow, you can blame them on Sir Roland, lady, Eddie thought sourly. Instead, they went to the arms of the chair and gripped them as she regarded the two men. Behind her, the doorway had already disappeared. Disappeared? That was not quite right. It seemed to fold in on itself, like a piece of film run backward. This began to happen just as the store dick came slamming through the other, more mundane door, the one between the store and the dressing room. He was coming hard, expecting the shoplifter would have locked the door, and Eddie thought he was going to take one hell of a splat against the far wall, but Eddie was never going to see it happen or not happen. Before the shrinking space where the door between that world and this disappeared entirely, Eddie saw everything on that side freeze solid. The movie had become a still photograph. All that remained now were the dual tracks of the wheelchair, starting in sandy nowhere and running 4 feet to where it and its occupant now sat. "Won't somebody please explain where I am and how I got here?" the woman in the wheelchair asked, almost pleaded. "Well, I'll tell you one thing, Dorothy," Eddie said. "You ain't in Kansas anymore." The woman's eyes brimmed with tears. Eddie could see her trying to hold them in, but it was no good. She began to sob. Furious and disgusted with himself as well, Eddie turned on the gunslinger, who had staggered to his feet. Roland moved, but not toward the weeping lady. Instead, he went to pick up his knife. "Tell her!" Eddie shouted. "You brought her, so go on and tell her, man!" And after a moment he added, in a lower tone, "And then tell me how come she doesn't remember herself." 4. Roland did not respond, not at once. He bent, pinched the hilt of the knife between the two remaining fingers of his right hand, transferred it carefully to his left, and slipped it into the scabbard at the side of one gun belt. He was still trying to grapple with what he had sensed in the lady's mind. Unlike Eddie, she had fought him like a cat, from the moment he came forward until they rolled through the door. The fight had begun the moment she sensed him. There had been no lapse because there had been no surprise. He had experienced it, but didn't in the least understand it. No surprise at the invading stranger in her mind, only the instant rage, terror, and the commencement of a battle to shake him free. She hadn't come close to winning that battle, could not, he suspected, but that hadn't kept her from trying like hell. He had felt a woman insane with fear and anger and hate. He had sensed only darkness in her. This was a mind entombed in a cave-in. Except that in the moment they burst through the doorway and separated, he had wished desperately that he could tarry a moment longer. One moment would have told so much. Because the woman before them now wasn't the woman in whose mind he had been. Being in Eddie's mind had been like being in a room with jittery, sweating walls. Being in the lady's had been like lying naked in the dark while venomous snakes crawled all over you. Until the end. She had changed at the end. And there had been something else. Something he believed was vitally important. But he either could not understand it or remember it. Something like a glance, the doorway itself, only in her mind. Something about you broke the for special, it was you, some sudden burst of understanding. As at studies, when you finally saw, "Oh, fuck you," Eddie said disgustedly, "you're nothing but a goddamn machine." He strode past Roland, went to the woman, knelt beside her, and when she put her arms around him, panic tight, like the arms of a drowning swimmer, he did not draw away, but put his own arms around her and hugged her back. "It's okay," he said. "I mean, it's not great, but it's okay."
"Where are we?" she wept. "I was sitting home watching TV so I could hear if my friends got out of Oxford alive, and now I'm here, and I don't even know where here is."
"Well, neither do I," Eddie said, holding her tighter, beginning to rock her a little. "But I guess we're in it together. I'm from where you're from, little old New York City, and I've been through the same thing, well, a little different, but same principle, and you're gonna be just fine." As an afterthought, he added, "as long as you like lobster." She hugged him and wept, and Eddie held her and rocked her, and Roland thought Eddie will be all right now. His brother is dead, but he has someone else to take care of, so Eddie will be all right now. But he felt a pang, a deep, reproachful hurt in his heart. He was capable of shooting with his left hand anyway, of killing, of going on and on, slamming with brutal relentlessness through miles and years, even dimensions, it seemed, in search of the tower. He was capable of survival, sometimes even of protection. He had saved the boy Jake from a slow death at the way station and from sexual consumption by the Oracle at the foot of the mountains, but in the end he had let Jake die. Nor had this been by accident. He had committed a conscious act of damnation. He watched the two of them, watched Eddie hug her, assure her it was going to be all right. He could not have done that. And now the rue in his heart was joined by stealthy fear. If you have given up your heart for the tower, Roland, you have already lost. A heartless creature is a loveless creature, and a loveless creature is a beast. To be a beast is perhaps bearable, although the man who has become one will surely pay hell's own price in the end. But what if you should gain your object? What if you should, heartless, actually storm the dark tower and win it? If there is naught but darkness in your heart, what could you do except degenerate from beast to monster? To gain one's object as a beast would only be bitterly comic, like giving a magnifying glass to an elephant. But to gain one's object as a monster, to pay hell is one thing, but do you want to own it? He thought of Allie, and of the girl who had once waited for him at the window. Thought of the tears he had shed over Cuthbert's lifeless corpse. Oh, then he had loved. Yes, then. "I do want to love," he cried. But although Eddie was also crying a little now with the woman in the wheelchair, the gunslinger's eyes remained as dry as the desert he had crossed to reach this sunless sea. Five. He would answer Eddie's question later. He would do that because he thought Eddie would do well to be on guard. The reason she didn't remember was simple. She wasn't one woman, but two. and one of them was dangerous. 6. Eddie told her what he could, glossing over the shootout but being truthful about everything else. When he was done, she remained perfectly silent for some time, her hands clasped together on her lap. Little streamlets coursed down from the shallowing mountains, petering out some miles to the east. It was from these that Roland and Eddie had drawn their water as they hiked north. At first Eddie had gotten it because Roland was too weak. Later they had taken turns, always having to go a little further and search a little longer before finding a stream. They grew steadily more listless as the mountains slumped, but the water hadn't made them sick. So far. Roland had gone yesterday, and although that made today Eddie's turn, the gunslinger had gone again, shouldering the hide water skins and walking off without a word. Eddie found this queerly discreet. He didn't want to be touched by the gesture, by anything about Roland for that matter, and found he was a little just the same. She listened attentively to Eddie, not speaking at all, her eyes fixed on his. At one moment, Eddie would guess she was 5 years older than he. At another, he would guess 15. There was one thing he didn't have to guess about. He was falling in love with her. When he had finished, she sat for a moment without saying anything, now not looking at him but beyond him, looking at the waves which would, at nightfall, bring the lobsters, and with their alien lawyerly questions. He had been particularly careful to describe them. Better for her to be a little scared now than a lot scared when they came out to play. He supposed she wouldn't want to eat them, not after hearing what they had done to Roland's hand and foot, not after she got a good close look at them. But eventually hunger would win out over Didichick and Dumachum. Her eyes were far and distant. Odetta? He asked after perhaps 5 minutes had gone by. She had told him her name, Odetta Holmes. He thought it was a gorgeous name. She looked back at him, startled out of her reverie. She smiled a little. She said one word. No. He only looked at her, able to think of no suitable reply. He thought he had never understood until that moment how illimitable a simple negative could be. "I don't understand," he said finally. "What are you knowing?" "All this?" Odetta swept an arm. She had, he'd noticed, very strong arms, smooth but very strong, indicating the sea, the sky, the beach, the scruffy foothills where the gunslinger was now presumably searching for water, or maybe getting eaten alive by some new and interesting monster, something Eddie didn't really care to think about. Indicating, in short, this entire world. I understand how you feel. I had a pretty good case of the unrealities myself at first. But had he? Looking back, it seemed he had simply accepted, perhaps because he was sick, shaking himself apart in his need for junk. You get over it. No, she said again. I believe one of two things has happened, and no matter which one it is, I am still in Oxford, Mississippi. None of this is real. She went on. If her voice had been louder, or perhaps if he had not been falling in love, it would almost have been a lecture. As it was, it sounded more like lyric than lecture. Except, he had to keep reminding himself, bullshit's what it really is. And you have to convince her of that, for her sake. I may have sustained a head injury, she said. They are notorious swingers of axe handles and billy clubs in Oxford Town. Oxford Town? That produced a faint chord of recognition far back in Eddie's mind. She said the words in a kind of rhythm that he for some reason associated with Henry. Henry and wet diapers. Why? What? Didn't matter now. You're trying to tell me you think this is all some sort of dream you're having while you're unconscious? Or in a coma, she said. And you needn't look at me as though you thought it was preposterous, because it isn't. Look here. She parted her hair carefully on the left, and Eddie could see she wore it to one side, not just because she liked the style. The old wound beneath the fall of her hair was scarred and ugly, not brown, but a grayish white. "I guess you've had a lot of hard luck in your time," he said. She shrugged impatiently. "A lot of hard luck and a lot of soft living," she said. "Maybe it all balances out. I only showed you because I was in a coma for 3 weeks when I was 5. I dreamed a lot then. I can't remember what the dreams were, but I remember my mama said they knew I wasn't going to die just as long as I kept talking, and it seemed like I kept talking all the time, although she said they couldn't make out one word in a dozen. I do remember that the dreams were very vivid." She paused, looking around. "As vivid as this place seems to be. And you, Eddie." When she said his name, his arms prickled. Oh, he had it all right, had it bad. "And him," she shivered. "He seems the most vivid of all." "We ought to. I mean, we are real, no matter what you think." She gave him a kind smile. It was utterly without belief. "How did that happen?" he asked. "That thing on your head." "It doesn't matter. I'm just making the point that what has happened once might very well happen again." "No, but I'm curious." "I was struck by a brick. It was our first trip north. We came to the town of Elizabeth, New Jersey. We came in the Jim Crow car."
"What's that?"
She looked at him unbelievingly, almost scornfully. "Where have you been living, Eddie? In a bomb shelter?"
"I'm from a different time," he said. "Could I ask how old you are, Odetta?"
"Old enough to vote and not old enough for Social Security."
"Well, I guess that puts me in my place."
"But gently, I hope," she said, and smiled that radiant smile which made his arms prickle.
"I'm 23, he said, "but I was born in 1964, the year you were living in when Roland took you."
"That's rubbish."
"No, I was living in 1987 when he took me."
"Well," she said after a moment, "that certainly adds a great deal to your argument for this as reality, Eddie. The Jim Crow car, was it where the black people had to stay?"
"The Negroes," she said.
"Calling a Negro a black is a trifle rude, don't you think?"
"You'll all be calling yourselves that by 1980 or so," Eddie said. "When I was a kid, calling a black kid a Negro was apt to get you in a fight. It was almost like calling him a nigger."
She looked at him uncertainly for a moment, then shook her head again.
"Tell me about the brick, then."
"My mother's youngest sister was going to be married," Odetta said. "Her name was Sophia, but my mother always called her Sister Blue because it was the color she always fancied. Or at least she fancied to fancy it, was how my mother put it. So I always called her Aunt Blue even before I met her. It was a most lovely wedding. There was a reception afterward. I remember all the presents."
She laughed.
"Presents always look so wonderful to a child, don't they, Eddie?"
He smiled. "Yeah, you got that right. You never forget presents. Not what you got, not what somebody else got either."
"My father had begun to make money by then. But all I knew is that we were getting ahead. That's what my mother always called it. And once, when I told her a little girl I played with had asked if my daddy was rich, my mother told me that was what I was supposed to say if any of my other chums ever asked me that question, that we were getting ahead. So they were able to give Aunt Blue a lovely china set, and I remember..."
Her voice faltered. One hand rose to her temple and rubbed absently, as if a headache were beginning there.
"Remember what, Odetta?"
"I remember my mother gave her for special."
"What?"
"I'm sorry. I've got a headache. It's got my tongue tangled. I don't know why I'm bothering to tell you all this anyway."
"Do you mind?"
"No, I don't mind. I meant to say Mother gave her a special plate. It was white with delicate blue tracework woven all round the rim."
Odetta smiled a little. Eddie didn't think it was an entirely comfortable smile. Something about this memory disturbed her, and the way its immediacy seemed to have taken precedence over the extremely strange situation she had found herself in, a situation which should be claiming all or most of her attention,
disturbed him.